DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Hello and welcome to this edition of DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories from behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Kate Laycock.
And I'm Andre Leslie. Coming up on the show, after charges are brought in the New Delhi gang rape case, we talk crime and punishment with lawyer Verinda Grover.
Then, welcome to Kennesaw, Georgia, the US town where it's illegal not to carry a weapon.
It's a shotgun. It was my husband's, and I do keep it just in case somebody would enter my home to harm me or my family.
And on the road in Kurdistan, how aid workers are struggling to help the growing influx of Syrian refugees.
That and a whole lot more coming up on Worldlink. On DW's Worldlink, I'm Kate Laycock.
And I'm Andre Leslie. The sound of demonstrators in New Delhi calling for a halt to harassment and violence against women.
The background to this is, of course, the vicious attack on an unnamed woman and her male companion on a bus on December 16, 2012. The woman, a 23-year-old student who dreamed of becoming a doctor, was brutally gang-raped, so brutally that she has since died of her injuries.
Five men have now been charged, but campaigners say that is not enough. In India, a rape is reported every 20 minutes, and the real figure is thought to be much higher, suggesting that political and cultural change is needed if women are to feel safe. Earlier, Kate and I spoke to Verinda Grover, a Delhi-based lawyer working on issues of human rights and impunity, who has done extensive work on rape law amendments, women's issues, and has been on several fact-finding commissions. We started by asking her whether she was surprised by the nature of this brutal attack.
It has outraged us. It's not at all surprising. And even post the incident, every single day we are hearing of equally horrific incidents of sexual violence and sexual assault from across the country. What was good was that it did outrage us to an extent that everybody came out to protest publicly. And in some senses, perhaps you could say it was the tipping point. But it's not isolated. There is the sexual violence against women in this country of all forms, whether it relates to sexual harassment or brutal rape of the kind that this young woman had to experience, is fairly widespread and systematic. So, and also the brazenness with which this was committed right in the heart of the capital is not surprising. There has been complete impunity for sexual violence, and that what we are seeing today could only be the consequence of years of condoning and sanctioning sexual violence against women.
What made you, Verinda, as a lawyer, get involved with the issue of rape and violence against women?
Well, it's interesting. I think there wouldn't be a single woman that I know who has not in her own personal life in some form or the other experienced sexual abuse, whether in private space or in public space. And in many ways, I got involved with the feminist movement through issues of sexual harassment, both in public transport, in public buses, as well as in college, and became part of a street theater group, and one thing led to the other, and then finally became a lawyer for precisely these reasons.
Looking at the protests which have been taking place in Delhi and elsewhere in solidarity of the victim of the Delhi gang rape, one of the things that many women have been saying as they demonstrate on the streets is this woman's sacrifice, this woman's suffering should not be in vain. What will have to happen for that to be true?
There are many indicators to see that this woman's loss of life is not in vain. And I would, to just name a few, I would wait for in March when they are proposing to bring about the new legislation, I would also look at, are they going to make a change in the budgetary allocations? Are we going to see a greater allocation to the judiciary? Are we going to see a greater allocation to women's social justice issues, to women's economic empowerment? Or will we still see a very, very high defense budget and all the others slipping further below what were their previous allocations? I would also like to see that when they bring about the new law reforms that they are now saying that they may introduce on the first day of the budgetary session, which usually starts at the end of February. Will they bring about a law which will codify and grade a whole host of offences and get rid of notions of modesty, chastity, which the Indian Penal Code is besieged with, and which does not allow a lot of sexual violence that women face to even, it's not even recognized by law, leave aside finding any recourse for justice for it.
Charges have been made in the Delhi bus case. What do you think is the likely outcome?
Well, I think this case, because of the attention that it deserves and has got, there will be a speedy trial, there will be a conviction, and there will be the harshest punishment meted out to them. But what I would hope for is that will this case set the benchmark for all such cases of sexual violence, whether in terms of speedy and fair investigation or in terms of speedy and fair justice? Or will this be an isolated case and all the other cases of sexual violence will continue to languish?
That was Virinder Grover, lawyer and human rights activist in India.
The sounds of a Delhi prayer vigil in solidarity with victims of rape there. Now, remember this?
We've endured too many of these tragedies in the past few years. And each time I learn the news, I react not as a president, but as anybody else would, as a parent. And that was especially true today.
That was Barack Obama speaking after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, last month, where 20 children and 6 teachers were killed. The effects of that shooting are still being felt in the USA. President Barack Obama has said that he wants to make gun control a central issue going forward.
Nevertheless, there still are large sectors of the USA where gun ownership has widespread support, like Kennesaw in Georgia, for instance. It's a small town which even has a law requiring that every household should have access to a firearm and ammunition. Michael Scaturo has more from this unique town.
Welcome to Kennesaw, a town of 30,000 just north of the Georgia state capital, Atlanta. On outward appearances, it seems like any other U.S. town, but actually it's famous for its law requiring that every head of household own a gun. Even today, in the wake of the Newtown, Connecticut school massacre, this Second Amendment stronghold sees its right to bear arms as unshakable.
Yeah, there's quite a few gun enthusiasts, people who hunt and shoot a lot, that own assault weapons.
That's Lieutenant Craig Graydon, a detective in the Kennesaw Police Department. Graydon is a portly man with a friendly demeanor. He's the town's spokesman on the gun law, which has attracted interest from reporters from as far away as Japan in the wake of the Newtown shooting. Graydon has been a cop in this town for almost as long as the 1982 law has existed, and he says media reports of the town being a Wild West gun paradise are inaccurate. Only half of residents here own a gun, he says. And he says the law was a political statement back in 1981 in reaction to the Morton Grove gun ban in the U.S. state of Illinois.
The police department has never gone out and asked people, do you own a gun? And we don't track, in the state of Georgia, you don't register firearms, so there's no way to know who has how many firearms and things like that.
In the wake of the Newtown shooting, Graydon says he thinks Americans should worry less about gun control. He says they should instead start talking about insufficient funding nationwide for mental health treatment.
Right now, mental health is one of those areas that gets the least funding probably of everybody in the medical community, and that the systems are not very effective because most people, they're left to kind of deal with it on their own, private doctors and those kind of things. So, we're doing more like in Georgia and in Metro Atlanta, we call them crisis intervention teams, where we're training police officers to deal better with people experiencing mental health issues and building a better referral, database, and actually trying to intervene if somebody's having a problem, try to jump in and help them before it becomes a crisis type situation. But nationally, we need to do a much better job. And, that's my personal opinion.
Graydon says there might be a place for laws limiting the sale of rifles or clips like the ones used in Connecticut. Some locals express this sentiment as well. Bernadette is a woman in her early 60s, small, skinny, with a bun of grayish-white hair swept up at the neck. She doesn't want her last name mentioned on tape.
It's a shotgun. It was my husband's, and I do keep it just in case somebody would enter my home to harm me or my family. And I would hate to have to. I would hope that I would just show it and they would have sense to go.
Americans are evenly split on the issue of banning assault weapons, but a majority of Americans say they want the government to spend more on mental health treatment. Bernadette has a personal connection to the issue because her brother was diagnosed as a schizophrenic. Because of her own experience, she notices parents who have kids with mental illness. She speaks of a family in her neighborhood with a mentally ill child who occasionally gets violent in public.
Their life is so, you know, I don't know them, never have spoken to them, but you can tell they're home most of the time. And you just know that from my experience, although it was a different type of thing, that's what is their life.
On the other hand, Graydon, Bernadette, and others in Kennesaw with whom DW spoke were worried about stigmatizing the mentally ill. They're against creating lists to track those whose erratic behavior might one day become violent. Lieutenant Graydon said he himself is unsure of how to deal with certain situations that he has encountered with mentally ill young people.
Not even a month ago, we had a 12-year-old stab his father in the chest with a steak knife because he was having some type of an issue.
Graydon says there is no way to track this boy or to prevent him from buying a gun when he's of age. In addition to improving America's mental health safety net, Graydon also thinks the country should conduct a national discussion about violence in movies and video games, which he thinks has made young people desensitized to killing. He tells a story from his own high school years in the early 1980s to illustrate just how much he thinks things have changed since his childhood.
When I was in high school, that we carried guns to school because everybody hunted. I went to school not in Kennesaw, but close by in a neighboring county. And I can very much remember in the fall during hunting season that you would see a lot of the guys would have rifles in the back windows of their trucks because they had either gone hunting before class started that day or they were going to go hunting after school. But we never had any problems, and it was not really considered anything unusual.
If people here in Kennesaw agree on one thing, it's that they want more help in dealing with the mentally ill, not just a quick fix on gun control. But whether lawmakers in Washington will heed their calls remains unclear.
Michael Scaturo was in Kennesaw, Georgia, to provide that insight into the state of the gun control debate in the U.S.
Time now to take a journey through the Kurdistan area of northern Iraq in the company of two aid workers struggling to provide relief to the seemingly endless influx of Syrian refugees, many of them Kurds. As Hermione G is about to find out, their help cannot come a moment too soon to the men, women and children who have left everything in order to flee the violence in their native Syria.
It's a rainy winter afternoon, and Amir Harkey and Tom Robinson are driving an overloaded 4x4 through the Erbil rush hour. Co-founders of the Refugee Integration Support and Education, or RISE Foundation, they're on their way to deliver donations to Syrian refugees living in the city.
That part of town that we're going, there's over 100 families living there. But they're basically scattered around Erbil in different parts of the town. And there's continuous daily.
Every time we're there, we see it. We see a new family. And the thing is, a family can be anywhere from 2 to sort of 17. I think 14 or 17 is the biggest family we've seen.
The Syrians in Erbil are almost all Kurds, but they speak a different dialect of Kurdish than the locals, and most lack any kind of social support network here. The Kurdistan government has granted them the right to live and work anywhere in the region, and many of them are squatting in houses on the outskirts of town, hoping to find employment. But with winter setting in, Robinson explains, they're facing very harsh conditions.
There are those that have a decent enough house but are lacking supplies. On the other hand, there are these people that have quite literally nothing. The house is just a complete shell, no windows, no doors, kids not wearing shoes when it's cold and it's absolutely pouring with rain.
Once winter is over, RISE will offer longer-term support services to help the refugees re-establish themselves. As a doctor, Haki is very aware of their medical needs, and as well as setting up a mobile health clinic, wants to educate the refugees about the free medical services available to them in Kurdistan.
This will be an important part of the refugee rehabilitation. And others like education, community building, special programs for the women, interaction between the refugees and the local community just to make them feel they are part of
here. The integration part is very important. Yeah.
But today it's cold, dark and wet. And it's challenge enough to make sure people get the essentials. As the RISE trucks pull up on an unpaved, waterlogged street in the Kasnazan neighborhood, they're immediately surrounded by a crowd of men, women and children.
We're just trying to deliver some clothes and supplies now, but it turns into a real kind of mob scene very fast.
One family in need of help is 27-year-old Salah, his wife and two children. They came to Erbil 6 months ago, and they're struggling.
As a family, we pretty much need everything. Food is what we constantly require. I work when I can, but it might be 5 days work, 10 days without. The days that I don't work, we can't even afford to buy bread. There's never enough.
They are luckier than many and have a small but warm apartment they share with another family. And at least they're safe, Salah says.
It is difficult, but the security situation is good here. I left Syria because I was called up to serve in the army. If I'd gone to the army, I'd have to kill my own people, and I didn't want to do that. If I'd stayed, they might have executed me.
But they're all still hoping to go home, says Salah's uncle, Bozan.
We left Syria because we were worried about our kids, and now they're destroying our country. But in the end, I will go back. The soil of my country is dear to me, and this is not our home.
No one knows when that will be, but as long as the Syrians need help, says Amir Haki, Erbil's residents will make sure they're taken care of. It wasn't that long ago that they were refugees themselves.
There are so many people who are willing to help in either food donation or clothing donations or cash donation that we can manage the supply to those people. Really, the people here are trying as much as they can for help. For me, one of the motives actually was that I remember 1991 when we flew to the mountains because of the old regime Saddam. I remember the moments that I had no food to eat, no clothes to wear, with bare feet. And every time I see them, I remember myself. And that's like the local people. For them, actually, it doesn't make a difference that it's Kurds or Arab. As long as they see them, that they don't have any stuff to wear or any clothes to put on or any foods to eat, then the people are very eager to help.
Hermione G was reporting from the Kurdistan area of northern Iraq. Now, Andre, do you remember the old adage that a picture is worth a thousand words?
I do indeed, yeah. I use that saying every now and then myself, in fact.
And you're working in radio. Oh, dear. Well, anyway, in an arena in which words have become suspect, pictures do seem indeed to be worth more than words. That at least seems to be the conclusion of Kenyan artist and photographer Boniface Mwangi. Walk round Nairobi at the moment and you're bound to stumble across his work. That's because 2013 is an election year in Kenya, and Boniface is determined to ensure that the bloodshed which followed the elections 5 years ago will not be forgotten, and that's especially by the politicians themselves. Lucas Lawson has more.
Every day in Nairobi, people walk past reminders of the last election when over 1,000 people were killed in violent protests. On Mwindi Mabingu Street, next to the city market, the biggest reminder is a giant mural depicting Kenya's politicians as vultures responsible for the violence.
Hi, would you be willing to tell me what you think of the murals here?
I think these are a message for the Kenyan voters, because when you look at things like land grabbing, political assassination, tribal clashes, it's kind of a reflection for the voters.
Harrison Gashoka Ngojuna, a florist at the city market, sees the murals every day. They're the work of 29-year-old Boniface Mwangi, a photographer and activist.
So for me, it was from frustration that I was very upset about how this kind of has been managed. I was very upset that the media was in bed with politicians, and most of them own the mainstream media. I was upset that I could go and do a story, and then when I come back, it's going to be killed.
Many Kenyans blame their politicians for inciting the violence around the last elections in 2007 and 2008. The International Criminal Court in The Hague, the Netherlands, is now weighing a case against several active Kenyan politicians. Yet Kimani Jung Kimani Naganga, a taxi driver, worries that the mural's message isn't reaching enough people.
So had they been rotating, the information would go to more people. But currently they are only stagnant here, they're stagnated here. So the effective is very little, very minute.
In 2008, Mwangi and others took their collection of photographs on the road. They called the show Picha Mitani, which means street exhibition, and they showed it around Kenya for 3 years. Like the graffiti, many people considered the photographs a political message, and some local authorities banned the show.
And I thought, I'm going to be a jerk. I'm going to remind them every single day who is messing this country. My work is very direct. I call it boom tough. It's on your face.
Mwangi's confrontational approach scares off some would-be supporters.
Okay, let me tell you, I'm very controversial. So I'll attack a politician, and the people who claim to be reformists are going to defend the politician. Say, no, you're using bad language, your language is very abusive. So you have a lot of closeted supporters who will never openly support you, but that support is useless because that support cannot stop anything.
But Mwangi's traveling photo exhibit also attracted open support, including 61,000 people who signed pledge cards for peace. All told, 700,000 Kenyans visited the exhibit. After that, Mwangi began thinking of new ways to provoke Kenyans, so he recruited others and began a graffiti campaign. They painted murals on prominent walls around Nairobi overnight, but they met resistance.
Every time we did a graffiti, there were threats of being arrested, and I was summoned by police. But after that, we realized that the police, they came up with a smarter way. We do a graffiti, then they paint it. So it was defeating the whole process. So now we're going online. We're going to launch an online newspaper called Mavulture, which means many vultures. And we're going to put the records of every person who has ever worked in the government and who's waiting for a big post online, and it's available. Every corruption case they've been mentioned in and every accusation that is about them online. So you won't have this platform that when you're going to vote from an informed perspective.
Gojuna, the florist, agrees.
You cannot just vote because maybe you're voting for your brother. You should vote for the right leader. Yeah, so that you can have the results. And I think this is a very good message.
Ma Vulture launched on the 14th of November.
We are hoping that people who are opinion leaders, university students, and middle class, who have a voice back home, they can print whatever information we have online and take it back to the village. So we hope that the effect is that people can use that as a resource and go and educate other people.
And since Mwangi knows not everyone is willing to show their support openly, he's trying to get creative.
We're thinking of doing a mask protest. Hopefully when you come and you're wearing a mask, you can do anything you want and write anything on a placard and people won't know it's you.
Mwangi has also launched a workspace called Power 254. Power is the Swahili word for power, and 254 is Kenya's telephone country code. The space hosts a variety of creative activists, Mwangi says.
Who earn their living as photographers, or as journalists or cartoonists.
Mwangi says he wants Kenyans to turn their disgust into political action.
We want to get you upset and then tell you when you're angry you need to do something. And that something is not taking a machete or fighting your neighbor or just going to do a demonstration. You need to be able to see how do we organize and vote for change. How do we get a ballot revolution? How do people just come together and say, we need change, we need to build a new Kenya, and the only way we can do that is changing our leadership.
That was Lucas Lawson's profile of Kenyan artist Boniface Mwangi. This is DW's World Link, where I'm Andre Leslie.
And I'm Kate Laycock.
Onda do mar, maior temperatura subiu quando você caiu. Na minha mão, no meu cordão, meu coração se abriu. Rio de Janeiro, pra começar, você já não pode negar o sorriso inteiro, fevereiro, Brasil, o que você não viu. mão no meu cordão, meu coração se abriu, Rio de Janeiro.
You're listening to DW's Worldlink. In Bonn, I'm Kate Laycock.
And I'm Andre Leslie. Coming up in the second half of the show, Wagner at 200 years old, an insight into the man behind the music.
He was loquacious, he was charismatic, actually physically unattractive. He was just over 5 feet tall, had an eagle's nose and a very protruding chin, was unattractive in every way, but somehow he spellbound everyone he came into contact with, and there were some notable personalities among them.
First up, though, 2013 is now well underway, and that means it's back to work. So, to get you in the mood for the new working year, we'll be taking a look at three very different people in three very different jobs. A street hawker in Rio, a Kurdish mayor in Turkey, and a king in Morocco.
We're not ones to stand on ceremony, so let's begin with the street hawker. She's from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, which has a long-established history of informal traders, known locally as camelos. But who are these traders, and what has made them enter into the informal labour market? From Rio de Janeiro, Sam Cowie reports.
It's 6 a.m. and Maria de Lopes has just finished setting up her stall, or a barraca as it's known in Portuguese. Maria sells belts and women's fashion accessories. Her barraca is one of several opposite Carioca metro station, a main transport hub in Rio's downtown. Now in her early 40s, Maria has worked this area, hawking and selling for 15 years.
Eu sou mineira, né? Vivi uma vida muito pobre na cidade de Minas, assim.
I'm from rural Minas originally, a neighboring state. My father was a peasant who worked for someone else on a farm. I got married young. I was brought to Rio by one of my grandparents. I came to Rio and started to work on the street, which gave me some freedom and money to provide for my kids.
There are an estimated 50,000 camelos operating across Rio. Many, like Maria, migrated to the city fleeing rural poverty. Some, also like Maria, have barracas and permits. Some have no fixed point of sale and wander the streets looking for customers. Others ply their trades on the city's buses. Some travel from far outside the city and sleep on the street during the week, returning home at the weekends. Today is Friday, the busiest day of the week. Thanks to Brazil's booming economy, unemployment is at an all-time low. However, Maria explains why she and many others prefer to enter the informal labour market.
The thing is that if you work for someone else, all you're going to get is a minimum wage. If you work selling things yourself, you can make much more money. Working as a formalized employee for the minimum salary, there's no way I'd be able to pay for education and health insurance policies for my kids. And the public services in Rio are terrible.
É uma porcaria. No Brasil é uma porcaria, entendeu? Então assim.
Maria has 3 children. By working as a camelo, she is able to earn considerably more than Brazil's minimum wage of around 300 euros a month. The life of a camelo, although potentially more lucrative than formal employment, is nonetheless fraught with risks and difficulties. One of the primary difficulties is obtaining a license to trade in the first place. License application is a slow, bloated, bureaucratic process, not conducive to a life of hawking on the streets.
Então, os critérios era egresso penitenciário, né? Um cara que já foi preso e saiu da cadeia.
In order to get the barracha license, you had to have certain characteristics. You had to be an ex-criminal, older than 45, or have a physical disability. Because I didn't fit into any of those categories, I wasn't allowed. I had a friend who was over 45. We opened the barracha together, and he's the one who's officially in charge of it. With the money from the barracha, we support my family, his family, and 2 other families. Altogether, that's 14 people.
With the license difficulties, many camelos choose to work without formal permission, meaning they risk having their merchandise confiscated by the municipal guard. Maria explains.
Mas aquele que trabalha na rua, ele é menos sortudo do que todo mundo, entendeu? Ele é o pior que...
The camelos who are worst off are the people who just put a cloth on the ground and start selling stuff. As soon as the municipal guard comes, they just wrap up their stuff and run away. The worst thing that can happen is that they lose their merchandise. The municipal guard comes along, confiscates their merchandise, they haven't got anything to sell and they've lost their investment and they don't make any profit.
At around 2:30, after the lunchtime rush, Maria leaves the barraca with her brother Carlos and takes me to meet a group of camelos who are operating without licenses. Luis Henrique travels for about 2 hours to get to work each day from Nova Iguaçu, a suburb of Rio. He used to work as a private security guard. Now he sells kitchen cloths from a customized bicycle.
A gente pega a mercadoria e sai correndo. Sai um avisando pro outro colega, sai, sai, guarda tá vindo e...
If the guards come, I get on my bike and go and shout to my colleagues that the Guarda Municipal is coming. If we get caught, our stuff gets confiscated. The process takes about 2 weeks. You have to prove that you bought the stuff with receipts. However, if I have 500 sheets confiscated, chances are I'll only get back about 250.
Porque alguma coisa sempre some.
Maria returns to the barraca. It's 4 p.m. and the early evening rush is beginning. Rio de Janeiro will be one of the host cities for the 2014 Soccer World Cup, an event that could be very profitable for Maria and the rest of the city's camelos. However, stipulations made by FIFA, the governing body of the event, mean that during the World Cup, business will not be running as usual. Maria explains.
Então, a zona de exclusão é que a FIFA, né, ela impôs na cidade. É incrível isso, né?
It's like this. FIFA have imposed exclusion zones. We're not allowed within 500 meters of any of the events. I've been working this area for 15 years. If anything to do with the World Cup is set up here, I can't work here.
It's now 10 p.m. and Maria is just finishing up for the day. Tomorrow is Saturday and downtown Rio de Janeiro will be empty. Maria dismantles her barraca. Soon a van that is shared between her and the other camelos who have barracas nearby will come and collect her merchandise. She'll spend the weekend with her family before hitting the streets again on Monday.
Sam Cowie packing up for the day in Rio de Janeiro.
For decades, Turkey has been racked by a brutal conflict with Kurdish rebels who are fighting for greater cultural rights and autonomy. But a local mayor in Turkey's largest Kurdish city, Diyarbakir, has been waging a peaceful battle for minority rights. As a result of that struggle, he's been stripped of office and has faced a never-ending series of court cases. Our correspondent, Dorian Jones, spent a day with the mayor and discovered that the struggle has now become very personal.
A Kurdish folk song is sung at the Dicle Ferhat Cultural Center in the Sur district of Diyarbakir. Listening is Sur district's mayor, Abdullah Demirbaş. The center is one of his proudest creations and a key part of his lifelong struggle to ensure the survival of his Kurdish culture and language.
People exist only through their identity and culture, and I've been fighting to preserve and protect this identity all my life. According to the law, it's illegal to provide any services in languages other than Turkish. Our culture, our people, don't exist in the eyes of the law. When I became mayor in 2005, I carried out a survey to find out what the people wanted and what they needed. We did a survey of 7,000 families in this Sur municipality. That means 70,000 people, and 70% speak Kurdish as a mother tongue. That's why I am committed to serving the people.
The cultural center has a special place in Demirbaş's heart. For 3 years, it served as his office in exile. He was removed as mayor by the interior minister. His crime? Producing service information in Kurdish. Demirbaş shows some of the printed material deemed to be highly subversive, including health information, as well as a children's book encouraging respect for the environment. He explains his removal from office has had a profound effect on his family.
It makes me so sorry. It breaks my heart that this still continues, because this is who I am, who my family is. I am not fighting just for the Kurds. I'm fighting for diversity of this region, Assyrian Christians, the Armenians, the Arabs. For the last 85 years, we've been told that they are only Turks and only one region. And people who challenge this are always declared to be terrorists, enemies of the state, criminals. This is why we have so much fighting. There will always be clashes with this mentality. I was removed from office and threatened with jail. When I was stripped of office, my eldest son decided to go to the mountains and join the PKK to fight the state. He saw no hope for a peaceful struggle. His decision shocked all my family as he was only 16 years old.
As Demirbaş gives me a tour around the narrow ancient streets of the Sur district of Diyarbakır, he's frequently stopped by the people. His efforts and sacrifices appear to be appreciated by the locals, like this man.
When there's a good mayor like him, the state doesn't like it and puts obstacles in their way. We love him for how he fights for his people, not only Kurds, but for Armenians and Assyrians. Because we're all brothers living here together, and he helped to get all our identities recognized. No one has the right to forbid who we are, but the state doesn't like this reality.
Such support resulted in Demirbaş being re-elected, despite a strong campaign against him by the governing AK party. The government claims they are committed to Kurdish reforms, pointing to a state Kurdish television channel and elective Kurdish classes. But at the same time, it stepped up its crackdown against people like Demirbaş. At his office in the Sur Municipal Building, Demirbaş shows me the latest court cases against him. Many charges are for putting up street signs in Kurdish, including a sign welcoming people to the city of Diyarbakır. He admits he may not be mayor for much longer if state prosecutors have their way.
There are 72 court cases against me for all the things I've implemented and also about the thoughts I've expressed. The sentences add up to 496 years, though one charge has been dropped, so it's now 493 years. An interesting case is when we issued a job application for the municipality and put in a requirement to speak Armenian, Kurdish, and Assyrian. We were taken to court over this, but we won that case. Now we can hire personnel with those qualifications.
Demirbaş worries not for himself. Jail is an occupational hazard, he says. 33 Kurdish mayors are currently in prison. And this year has already seen over 1,000 of his party colleagues detained under anti-terror laws. But Demirbaş says the growing legal crackdown can only exacerbate the conflict between the state and the Kurdish rebels, the PKK. He warns such arrests and prosecutions can only drive more young Kurds, like his son, to conclude that peaceful struggle is hopeless and the answer is to join the PKK. But Demirbaş says it's the duty of all politicians to strive for peace.
Bakın, benim bir oğlum PKK'de. Diğer oğlum da askere gidecek.
One of my sons is in the PKK. My other son has just received his papers calling him to do his compulsory military service in the Turkish army. Who can want peace more than I do? There are tens of thousands of Kurdish families like us whose sons are in the mountains or in prison. We all want peace because our hearts are in pieces. One piece up in the mountain, the other in prison, another in the military. Look, today when an airplane takes off to bomb the PKK bases in Kandil, I don't sleep at night, wondering what will happen to my son. The mother of a soldier longs for her son, the same as a mother of a guerrilla. Before tomorrow is too late, before deaths increase, we the politicians should solve this problem.
Ne zaman ki Kürt annelerinin
That report was by Dorian Jones. Now, from a mayor to a king.
It's just over 2 years since demonstrators took to the streets in Tunisia, beginning a wave of revolutions that rolled across the Arab world. Regimes fell there, then in Egypt, Libya and Yemen. People rose up too in Bahrain and Syria. But Morocco's Mohammed VI, whose absolute rule and vast fortune might have made him an early victim of this unrest, has become a notable Arab Spring survivor. In the Moroccan capital, Rabat, John Lawrenson has been finding out why.
Soldiers in full regalia sweat in the sun as men in overalls unroll a long red carpet. The king is coming to open a new session of parliament, a parliament with extended powers thanks to a new, slightly more democratic constitution. That constitution says the sovereign is no longer sacred, but you would never know it from the crowd packed tight behind the barricades.
Mohamed VI, le vrai Amir le Mouminin.
Mohammed VI is the true commander of the faithful. Mohammed VI, God has given him glory. Mohammed VI, His Majesty, the King, descendant of the Prophet. Allah has decreed that Mohammed VI has the tongue of the Prophet.
À la langue du prophète.
Par-ci, par-là, on entend des critiques.
Here and there you hear criticism, people who say he's too rich, he's too powerful. You're not rich.
Vous n'êtes pas riche, vous.
Oui, je suis un pauvre, mais le Dieu qui choisit...
No, I'm a poor man, but it's God who decides whether we are rich or poor. The sort of criticism you are talking about, it's a waste of your breath. We are for the king, and we will always be for the king.
On est toujours avec le roi.
Mohammed VI portraits are given out while plainclothes police haul some 10 men out of the crowd and march them into a police van. Not a murmur of protest from them or the crowd. And suddenly the king arrives, striding purposefully in a cream-coloured jellaba and sunglasses, looking rather stouter than in his photos. Malik, cries the crowd. Sidna, our king, our lord. For all the accolades, King Mohammed is something of an enigma. His photo is in every shop and cafe and hotel and restaurant, but he rarely gives interviews.
And because the monarchy had monopoly over the use of that force...
On the roof of a house in the old city, the political scientist Abdoulaye Moudan is giving a seminar to a group of American students. I ask him about the king. He tries to explain the monarchy's popularity.
I don't know whether it is love, because love is very difficult to determine, politically speaking. But the king provides to society the security that there is someone up there, someone there who is concerned. And this is the first king who has traveled more than any other king in the previous history of Morocco.
To get out there and meet the people.
Meet people, shake people. This is the first king who is kissing babies.
The same family has ruled Morocco for 3.5 centuries. Abdoulaye Moudan says if Mohammed VI has escaped so far the fate of many other Arab autocrats, it's because he made real concessions to both liberals and Islamists before the Arab Spring. But he also has been very successful at reinforcing among Moroccans the link between the monarchy and Islam. At the wheel of his car, Abdel Salam Zian chants along to Quranic verses on the radio station where he's director of programmes. It's called Mohammed VI Radio. The king set it up 8 years ago. This year, it became the most popular radio station in the country. Something extraordinary for a station broadcasting only prayer, scripture and religious advice.
Religion is intimately linked with the private life of each Muslim. Every time they have a decision to take about what to do in a given situation, they want to know what the religious position is. Our mission here is to answer their questions. Moroccans want to safeguard their religion for future generations, a moderate, peaceful religion.
Muhammad But the king does have his critics. Abdallah Shibani is a co-founder of Justice and Spirituality, a movement banned as a political party. Shibani spent 2 years in prison for his opposition to the king. He believes the king exploits religion to legitimise his authority, which he then uses to bolster his own finances. His movement has sent a letter to the king asking him to change and become, as he sees it, a true commander of the faithful.
He told him, you have an occasion to practice good Islam. If you take all this money of the people and restitute...
Give it back.
Give it back to the people.
Justice and Spirituality is against the use of violence to take power, but warns that the king's wealth makes revolution likely in this poor country. The fact is, though, that the demonstrations for radical change of early 2011 have stopped. Right now, Moroccans seem less prone to take to the streets to condemn the king than to praise him.
John Lawrenson was hobnobbing with royalty for that report from the Kingdom of Morocco. And we're about to continue in a royal vein, musical royalty, that is.
...2013 marks the 200th anniversary of the birth of German composer Richard Wagner. Throughout the year, Deutsche Welle will be bringing you a whole host of Wagner-related sounds and stories, all collected together on DW's very own Wagner 200 page. Just go to dw.de/culture and follow the links from there if you want to check it out. So, not to be outdone, Worldlink has invited DW's very own music expert, Rick Fulker, into the studio to talk to us about Richard Wagner, the man behind the music. Welcome to the studio, Rick.
It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to be on Worldlink.
Now, look, Rick, before we start, I've got just one question. As we've just heard, DW's really going to town about Richard Wagner this year. But why all the fuss? I mean, is he really worth it? What's the significance of Wagner now in 2013, do you think?
He was a playwright, an author, an essayist, a composer, a producer, a director, an architect. And in all of these fields, he was relevant in the 19th century, but nothing more than in music, where he redefined music history, took musical romanticism as far as it could possibly go, and from there he led to the modern era of music, even into atonalism. So he is musically significant. He is called, first and foremost, the composer. So that's reason enough in our view.
Let's go to the beginning. 22nd of May, 1813. Richard Wagner's born. He's born in Leipzig. And his beginnings are pretty humble, aren't they, Rick?
Yes, they are. His mother was a baker's daughter. His father was a police actuary. His father died 6 months after the baby was born. The mother married Ludwig Geyer, an actor. But that was really his humble beginnings. He had no major support other than his own pure willpower.
So that's what propelled him forward?
Always, always. And basically, he forced himself on people. He forced himself on the world of art, on the world of music, and they didn't want him. And still, he persisted throughout his life until he was finally craved after by just masses, multitudes, royalty, followers. He was the master.
He sounds like a little bit of a know-it-all, but what was he really like as a person? I mean, sort of, you know, do you have any sort of snippets there that give an insight into his personal life?
Well, he was a megalomaniac, of course. He was a revolutionary. He was involved in the revolutionary uprisings in Europe, in Dresden, particularly in 1849. He became a fugitive. He wanted to change the world, first of all, by service of fire and not art. His major work was a 25-year project called Der Ring des Nibelungen, and it was the four-opera cycle. He interrupted work on it to try to come up with an opera that be performable, and that was Tristan und Isolde. Unfortunately, it was 5 hours long, and after 72 rehearsals, it was deemed unperformable. And then things went on from there. Always, always, it was a major struggle. And in fact, the first Tristan died after those rehearsals. That's
stress?
Well, one can certainly come to conclusions about that, yes.
His work is generally very fiery, very romantic stuff. Does this reflect Wagner the man as well?
Yes, he was loquacious. He was charismatic, actually physically unattractive. He was just over 5 feet tall, had an eagle's nose and a very protruding chin, was unattractive in every way, but somehow he spellbound everyone he came into contact with. And there were some notable personalities among them, apart from revolutionaries in earlier years. Later on, it was philosophers, Nietzsche, all the composers flocked to Wagner to pay their reverence and to learn from him.
So those are his admirers, Rick, but let's talk about his lovers, because there are a few of them as well.
More than a few. In fact, from his earliest years until his final day of life, he was involved in extramarital affairs. One of them was when he was a fugitive in Switzerland. His benefactor, Otto Wesendonck, was a wealthy merchant. The benefactor's wife, Mathilde Wesendonck, was Wagner's lover. Whether platonic or more, one doesn't know, but there were extreme scenes of jealousy with Wagner's then-wife, Minna, and the whole thing fed, as so often in his life, passion led to art, and art led to passion, and it drew the women, and the women were then confirmed by this incredible music that flowed forth. And in this particular case, the Wagner-Wesendonck liaison culminated in the ultimate love story. There's never been anything more extreme ever written in terms of a love story, and it is Tristan and Isolde.
I want to talk briefly about Wagner's politics, because there, perhaps more than anywhere else, we get a sense of this man of contradictions, extremes and contradictions. You mentioned before that he was an exile, a refugee. Now, that was because of his involvement in an uprising in Dresden as a young man, and there he was very much on the side of leftists. This was a socialist uprising, albeit an abortive one. But then, as we get towards the older Wagner, he seems characterised by political conservatism. His oeuvre is very much involved with the idea of German nationalism, the creation of a myth of national character. Who was Wagner politically?
There is no statement by Wagner, and there are many of them, that isn't contradicted in another statement by Wagner. So it's kind of hard to figure that out sometimes. Indeed, you've summed up the full spectrum of what this man believed in and felt. At one point, he seems to have moved away from political revolutionary to operatic and art revolutionary. He wanted to change the world by means of art. And he did say extreme things that only a complete destruction of the total, of the order, of the present order can make possible a new world. His art was based on various sources, of course, most famously the old ancient German, Germanic and Nordic myths.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, you talk about the German side of it, and that's what ultimately made his work very appealing to the Nazis. Do you think his legacy has been tainted by that association?
Wagner, long before it was even socially en vogue or necessary, he wrote this infamous treatise called Judaism and Music, in which he said that the Jews were incapable of any sort of genuine art. They were only parasites on the body of creation, and that, in fact, the Jews as a whole, he actually said this, might receive some sort of redemption through annihilation. Now, this is pretty hard stuff to swallow. Of course, there was plenty to latch on to by later ideologues. After his death, his widow, Cosima, maintained a circle of friends, and they published these diatribes called the Bayreuther Blätter, in which there was a very xenophobic and a very ultra-nationalistic form of Germanism that was cultivated. Then came World War I. World War II, of course, his daughter-in-law had very, very close ties to the Nazis, direct. And in fact, 10 years before it was necessary, she invited Adolf Hitler to the Bayreuth Festival to meet the Klan.
So, 2013, despite that unfortunate period in Wagner and Bayreuth history, Wagner is not only revered, but he's experiencing something of a renaissance. Many Germans are rediscovering him or discovering him for the first time. Why is this? What's going on?
It's the music.
Thank you. DW's music man, Rick Fulker, who, by the way, believes that the legacy of Wagner is to be found in the modern cinematic score and the hardcore rock music of German band Rammstein.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. The presenters were me, Andre Leslie.
And me, Kate Laycock. Our studio technician was Jürgen Kuhn. If you'd like to hear any of the items in the programme again, go to dw.de/worldlink or look us up on iTunes. Worldlink is brought to you by DW in Bonn.